Hi, and welcome to the Chris Business Hour. I'm the Bear Cave, I'm Barry Slater, and today we will focus on the top stories from around the world, the nation, and the state. We're starting off with the West Fair Business Journal. We have an article written by Peter Katz. It's titled, MTA Board Approves Congestion Pricing Tolls. The Board of Directors of the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, or MTA, today voted to approve the schedule of tolls to be imposed on drivers entering Manhattan below 60th Street. The tolls are known as congestion pricing. Only one of the board's 23 members voted against the congestion pricing plan. The MTA plans to begin collecting the tolls in June, but that may be delayed if threatened lawsuits are filed to challenge the plan and ask the federal government to force the MTA to undertake a complete environmental review. The MTA anticipated that its congestion pricing would produce $1 billion a year to fund its capital programs, including the purchase of new subway cars and new rail cars for Metro North and the Long Island Railroad. The MTA says without congestion pricing, it runs the risk of falling behind on repair work necessary to update aging infrastructure and assets critical to the reliability of the system. The MTA estimates that its capital programs support 57,400 jobs and impact the economy at every level. The toll schedule calls for motorists who do not have Easy Pass and therefore will be billed by mail to be charged 50% more than the Easy Pass rates. Passenger vehicles and passenger type vehicles with commercial license plates would be charged a $15 peak period or $3.75 overnight period Easy Pass toll for entering the Central Business District or CBD in Manhattan no more than once per day. Trucks would be charged a $24 or $36 peak period or $6 or $9 overnight period Easy Pass toll for entering the CBD depending on their size. School buses contracted with the New York City Department of Education, commuter vans licensed with the New York City Taxi and Limousine Commission, and buses providing scheduled commuter services open to the public would be exempted from the CBD toll. Other buses would be charged a $24 or $36 peak period with a $6 or $9 overnight period Easy Pass toll for entering the CBD depending on their type. Motorcycles would be charged $7.50 or $1.75 overnight period Easy Pass toll for entering the CBD no more than once per day. Peak period toll rates would apply during the most congested times of the day from 5 a.m. to 9 p.m. on weekdays and 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. on weekends. Toll rates would be 75% lower in the overnight period. A tunnel crossing credit against the peak period CBD toll rate would be provided to vehicles with Easy Pass entering through the four tolled entries that lead directly into the CBD, the Queens Midtown, the Hugh L. Carey, Holland, and Lincoln Tunnels. Specialized government vehicles would be exempted from the CBD toll. Qualifying authorized emergency vehicles and qualifying vehicles transporting persons with disabilities would be exempt from the toll as required by law. Low-income vehicle owners who qualify and register for a low-income discount plan would receive a peak period Easy Pass toll rate that is 50% less than the passenger vehicle peak period Easy Pass toll rate on their eligible vehicle's 11th trip and trips thereafter in a calendar month. Next, from the West Fair Business Journal, an article written by Justin McGowan titled Regen Climate Technology Accelerator Launches First Cohort. Climate Haven, a New Haven-based nonprofit working to advance technology that can help decarbonize the global economy, and Caplack Ventures, an investment firm that supports climate-oriented startups from offices in New York City and Copenhagen, announced on March 26 the launch of their first cohort of climate startups from the ReGen Accelerator. The startups that participated in the first ReGen Accelerator include renewable energy companies, carbon capture and sequestration projects, and startups that seek to improve agricultural sustainability. Jesper Locke, Caplack Ventures chairman, said in a prepared statement, "Through our ReGen Accelerator program, we are committed to empowering startups to scale their impact and drive meaningful change in the fight against the climate crisis." The first five companies include Global Biochar, which seeks to implement scalable and profitable climate mitigation solutions while addressing food insecurity, presumably through the use of charcoal as a combination carbon sequestration and fertilizer. Next company, Tolum Earth, which is providing systems to make carbon offsets both easier for companies to acquire and more transparent regarding the impact they actually have using the Hedera blockchain network. TeamStack.ai, developers of an organizational tool which leverages AI to root out inefficiencies and help organizations align with their ecological, social, and corporate governance goals. AICH2, a company that seeks to disrupt several industries through the industrial-scale production of hydrogen using only renewable energy as early as 2025, and Tesleon, a creator launching an animated series called Captain Mariah's Map of the World, which will seek to inspire children to pursue climate activism. Each company in the accelerator will receive 2 months of training, access to industry experts, a network of investors, and overall assistance to their growth before participating in a May 28th demo day ahead of the Yale Innovation Summit. Congratulations are in order for these amazing companies, said Ryan Dings, Climate Haven CEO. Their ambition, creativity, and determination impressed us during our rigorous application process. We're very pleased to welcome them to ReGen and look forward to collaborating with them in creating a sustainable future for generations to come. Next, from the Westfair Business Journal, an article written by Bill Heltzel titled "Pearl River Movie Investors Awarded $27 Million Payout." A Rockland investment firm has made nearly $27 million on 4 films without collecting anything from box office revenues. Instead, U.S. District Judge Kathy Siebel ordered Creative Wealth Media Finance Corporation on March 20th to pay $26.9 million to Hudson LP and Hudson Private Corporation. In 2021, the Hudson Companies of Pearl River sued Creative Wealth of Toronto. They claimed they had loaned the film financing broker about $13 million for 4 movies. The movies include Bombshell 2019 with Charlize Theron and Nicole Kidman as employees of a toxic Fox News workplace, Capone, made in 2020 with Tom Hardy as Al Capone, Greyhound 2020 with Tom Hanks as a World War II Navy commander, and The Survivor in 2021 about a boxer haunted by memories of fighting concentration camp prisoners to survive during World War II. The films were made by Bronze Studios of Henderson, Nevada. The Hudson Companies, operated by Christopher Conover, claimed that some of the money was used for unrelated purposes and that Creative Wealth defaulted on the loans and refused to account for profits. Creative Wealth denied the accusations and claimed that the Hudson Companies owed the Canadian company $12.9 million. The Hudson loans were part of a larger deal whereby Creative Wealth loaned $16.5 million to Hudson LP to bail out previous loans that had no possibility of realizing returns, Creative claimed, and Hudson had repaid only $3.5 million. Last November, Creative Wealth was deemed bankrupt in Canada and was put under control of a trustee who advised Creative's Park Avenue, New York law firm that it was no longer authorized to represent the company. Judge Siebel gave Creative Wealth several weeks to hire a new attorney. The company missed the deadline and the judge granted a $26.9 million default judgment to the Hudson companies. And finally, from the Westfair Business Journal, an article written by Justin McGowan titled Nietzsche Names Stamford and New Haven Among Best Cities in America for Young Professionals. Nietzsche, or Niche, N-I-C-H-E, a data aggregation and visualization site, has ranked communities across America based on where they stand in a number of categories and, after crunching the numbers, ranked Stamford at number 107 overall out of every city in the United States with at least 100,000 people. New Haven came in at number 187. While only 230 cities of this size were included in the rankings by Niche, when considering the attractiveness of the cities for young professionals, Stamford and New Haven ranked 47 and 57 respectively. Both cities received their lowest marks, a D+, for the combined availability and affordability of housing while enjoying very high grades for their nightlife, diversity, and the commute offered to centers of employment. Commute, how about commute, offered to centers of employment, both likely helped along by easy access to New York City, which ranked number 65 overall. We'll now move to this week's Hartford Business Journal. First up, an article written by David Krzyzewski titled Lawmakers Consider Efforts to Boost Tourism at Mystic Seaport and the Connecticut Shoreline. Two bills that seek to improve tourism on the state's shoreline will be considered when the state legislature's Commerce Committee meets on Tuesday. The first, House Bill number 5432, seeks to establish a working group to develop a plan for expanding the tourism industry in the Mystic Seaport area of the towns of Stonington and Groton. The second, HB 5189, would require a study of ways to promote and grow economic activity on the shoreline. HB 5432 was proposed by Representative Andre Bumgarten, a Democrat of Groton, who presented testimony in support of the bill during a public hearing on the bill held on March 14. Since last spring, municipal leaders, our state's top tourism attractions, including Mystic Seaport and Mystic Aquarium, community groups and residents have participated in locally led workshops and discussions on addressing our community transportation needs, Bumgarner said. I support any opportunity to collaborate with our partners to help facilitate investments to our regions, Bumgarner added. He told the committee there are several projects already underway in the area, including Mystic Seaport's proposal to restore the Rossi Velvet Mill as a multi-use facility that will open a new area of its campus to visitors. After their 50th anniversary, the Mystic Aquarium has many capital projects that are critical to the health and safety of their animals that they care for and rehabilitate, Bumgarner said, adding, there are many ideas that have been proposed by my Stonington legislative colleagues that could be discussed by a working group organized by the Connecticut General Assembly. In addition to the mill project, Bumgarner said, a recent proposal from Representative Greg Howard, a Republican from Stonington, would earmark a portion of state taxes generated from tourism for public safety, while Senator Heather Summers, a Republican from Groton, has championed enhanced water taxi service that would limit car traffic in our downtown core. I like that one. He said he has also requested legislation that would return the lodging taxes associated with short-term rentals back to the community where the rental properties are located, allowing those communities to receive back a small percentage of the significant revenue we generate for the state through tourism. He also suggested that the State Commissioner of Revenue Services or his designee should serve on the working group. It is essential that the group engages with the public in an open and transparent process that involves input from all stakeholders, including residents, business owners, and community leaders, Baumgartner said, adding, this process should include regular public meetings where residents can voice their concerns and provide feedback on proposed developments with public comment opportunities. Next up from this week's Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Michael Puffer. It's titled, Shuttered Waterbury Dealership to Be Replaced by National Collision Repair Chain Following $1.18 Million Sale. Louisville, Texas-based Caliber Collision will open a repair center in a new building at a former dealership property at 1200 Walcott Street in Waterbury. Waterbury officials confirmed the sale of the 3.8-acre property near the Wolcott town line on Friday to Torrington-based builder Colito Development Group, which is going to develop the property. Mayor Paul Pernarewski, it said Caliber, will employ about 40 people at that location, stabilizing a property that has been empty for years with a nationally recognized business. Pernarewski said the move will also help the city recruit additional businesses into vacant spaces along the retail-heavy artery. I firmly believe the more businesses you can attract to an area, the more attractive it becomes for others, Pernarewski said. Founded in 1997, Caliber has grown to more than 1,700 centers nationwide. Matt Ucolito of Colito Development said his family company paid $1.18 million for the property in a deal that closed on Friday. The plan is to divide the property roughly in half, knocking down a dilapidated vacant dealership building on the front portion and replacing it with a 12,500 square foot high bay building made for Caliber, which will lease the property. Colito specializes in developing properties for lease to national chains. It is preferred builder for Dollar General, O'Reilly Auto Parts, and Chipotle, as well as other retailers. Ucolito said he expects to demolish the existing dealership building at 1200 Wolcott Street by mid-April and finish construction within 6 months, including the purchase. Ucolito estimated the total project cost around $4.5 million. Next up from the Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Skylar Fraser is titled, Electric Boat and Pratt & Whitney Secure Big Navy Contracts. Two of Connecticut's largest employers and defense industry manufacturers won awards from the United States Navy last week, according to new information from the U.S. Department of Defense. East Hartford-based Pratt & Whitney and Groton-based Electric Boat secured military contracts totaling more than $165 million from the Navy for aerospace and submarine-related production. Electric Boat's contract, worth $145 million, was awarded March 21st and is for engineering, technical, design agent, and planning yard support for operational, strategic, and attack submarines. Most of the work for the contract, 70%, will be performed at Electric Boat's shipyard headquarters in Groton and is expected to be completed in September. Earlier in the week, on March 18th, Pratt & Whitney won a $20.2 million contract to provide training, test cell installation and commissioning, unit-level support equipment, automatic logistics integration, systems integration, software development, and warehouse IT network capability in support of depot site activation for the F-35 Lightning II program. About a third of the contract's work will be completed in East Hartford, while the rest will be done at facilities in North Carolina and Puerto Rico. The contract is expected to be completed in 2026. Next up, an article written by Dave Altamara and Jenna Carlesso titled, Connecticut Approves Prospect Medical Yale New Haven Deal, Paving the Way for the Sale. After 16 months of consideration, the state's Office of Health Strategy on Wednesday approved an application for a Certificate of Need from Yale New Haven Health, paving the way for it to potentially purchase three troubled hospitals owned by Prospect Medical Holdings. But the long-awaited approval is only the first step. The two hospital chains must now finalize a private deal that was first agreed upon nearly 2 years ago, but is now in danger of falling apart. Yale New Haven Hospital initially agreed in April 2022 to pay Prospect Medical $435 million to purchase Waterbury Hospital and the Eastern Connecticut Health Network, which includes both Manchester Hospital and Rockville General Hospital. But after a cyber attack debilitated operations across the three facilities for weeks and news of Prospect's growing debts came to light, Yale balked at the purchase price and is seeking to renegotiate it. Hospital leaders have said Prospect owes tens of millions of dollars to vendors, physicians under contract, and the state for provider taxes. One of the conditions of the agreement calls for the state to give Prospect Medical a break on its provider taxes. Prospect owes the state $67 million, but would get at least a $12 million tax break, decreasing its debt to the State Department of Revenue Services to $55 million. We are confident that we've come to an agreement that is in the best interest of the residents of Connecticut, which has been our priority since receiving this application, Dr. Deirdre Gifford, Executive Director of OHS, said Wednesday in a statement. I want to thank both the Yale and Prospect parties for their collaboration in reaching this agreement. With these conditions in place under new ownership of Yale New Haven Health, we can now expect that these hospitals will continue to operate and provide high-quality services to their patients and communities, she added. Governor Ned Lamont also issued a statement saying the deal ensures that the residents who live in each of the hospital's host communities will continue to have local access to essential medical care, and the jobs of the employees who provide this care will be preserved under this new ownership. I know that many people have been anxious to get to this day, and I completely understand their concerns. While it may have taken a little bit of time to get there, this process is an important part of the protections under the law to ensure that patients are receiving affordable, high-quality care and that the hospitals will continue meeting all their obligations to patients, employees, and the community at large, Lamont said. With today's approval by the Office of Health Strategy, I encourage Prospect to work with Yale to reach a deal that will allow them to finalize this purchase and bring a much-needed resolution to this transaction. Yale New Haven health officials have said the deal changed since it was first agreed upon in 2022 because of the cyber attack and Prospect's growing debts in Connecticut and needs to be revised. At one point last year, hospital officials met with Governor Lamont to seek as much as $80 million from the state to offset the cost of upgrading the three hospitals' computer security systems and help them recover from the cyber attack. Lamont rejected the plan and said that the privately owned companies needed to work out an agreement and the state would not sweeten the deal. The delays in this case has many legislators and health officials calling for an overhaul of the CON process. The state requires a certificate of need for closures, expansions, and other changes to healthcare facilities. If used correctly, the state certificate of need process is a tool to prevent crisis. Unfortunately, inefficient administration of the CON process has resulted in significant delays that have put in jeopardy access to health services for patients in our state, Kidwell said. Next up from this week's Hartford Business Journal, an article written by David Krzyzewski, entitled Danbury-based biopharmaceutical firm MannKind names a new CFO. MannKind Corporation, that's M-A-N-N, Kind, a Danbury-based company that develops inhaled therapeutic products, has named a new chief financial officer. The company said on Tuesday that current CFO Stephen Binder will retire effective April 22nd, though he will remain through the end of the year as executive vice president of special projects. Binder will be succeeded by Christopher Prentice, who joins MannKind after serving as CFO of Adarax Pharmaceuticals Incorporated, a privately held clinical stage biotechnology company based in San Diego. Prentice will join MannKind's executive leadership team and report to CEO Michael Castagna, the company said. We are excited to have Chris join us at such a pivotal time as our new CFO, Castagna said, adding, Chris will be responsible for ensuring we maintain our fiscal discipline as we continue to deleverage the balance sheet and invest behind our growth opportunities in the coming years. He added that the company is deeply grateful to Binder for his leadership and dedication to the company. Steve's fiscal stewardship has guided our recapitalization, helped us record nearly $200 million in total revenue last year, helped us achieve profitability in recent quarters, and bolstered the balance sheet with over $300 million in cash and investments at the end of 2023, Castagna said, adding, we are pleased that Steve will remain with MannKind for the rest of this year, allowing for an optimal transition with Chris. Prentice has more than 20 years of experience in financial leadership positions within the biopharma industry in both public and private companies. At Adarax, which he served as CFO since September of 2022, he helped raise nearly $250 million in funding. Before that, he held a series of finance positions of increasing responsibility at the commercial stage biotech company Adamas Pharmaceuticals Incorporated, culminating in his appointment as CFO. At the time, Adamas was acquired by Supernus Pharmaceuticals Incorporated in 2021. It had an annual revenue run rate of approximately $100 million. Next up from this week's Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Greg Bordenaro titled, Connecticut Credit Union Merger Approved. An East Hartford-based credit union that has been active in the M&A market has received regulatory approval to absorb a small Putnam credit union that serves Day Kimball Hospital employees. America's first network credit union on March 18 received permission from the State Department of Banking to merge with Northeastern Connecticut Healthcare Credit Union in Putnam. America's first will be the surviving entity. The proposed effective date of the merger is April 1st, according to the banking department. As part of the proposed merger, America's first sought permission to expand its field of membership to include healthcare workers, which is Northeastern Connecticut's main customer base. According to its website, Northeastern serves healthcare employees in a 13-town area. America's First Network has $74.6 million in assets, 6,892 members, and a branch presence in North Haven, Trumbull, Groton, Hartford, and East Hartford, according to the National Credit Union Administration data. Northeastern has $10.3 million in assets and 1,693 members with a single branch at Day Kimball Hospital. America's first network credit union is led by CEO Nicholas Moale, who told the Hartford Business Journal in 2020 that he had plans to double the size of the financial institution over a five-year period. At the time of that interview in February of 2020, the credit union had $36 million in assets and was in the process of acquiring North Haven-based Connecticut Federal Credit Union and Hartford's CT Transit Federal Credit Union. America's first network credit union was originally headquartered in Trumbull, but moved its main office to East Hartford following its 2017 merger with East Hartford Federal Credit Union. We'll now move on to the Thursday, March 28th New York Times business section, starting off with the Business News Roundup Dealbook newsletter. First article is Life Magazine will come back to, well, life. Life, the iconic photography-focused chronicler of the 20th century, has taken on many forms, including a weekly magazine, a website, and the occasional special issue. Now it is set to resume regular print publication, thanks to a deal between Barry Diller's IAC and Josh Kushner, the venture capitalist whose Thrive Capital is one of the biggest investors in OpenAI, and his wife, the entrepreneur and model, Carly Kloss. Kushner and Kloss are buying the publication rights to Life from Dot Dash Meredith, the print and digital publisher. The deal is being done through Bedford Media, the media startup that Kloss leads as CEO. The price was not disclosed. Life was once a central part of American culture, featuring the work of renowned photographers like Robert Capa and writing by top authors. Ernest Hemingway's The Old Man and the Sea first appeared in its pages. But its popularity plunged after the 1970s, with the magazine largely being reduced to light reading and celebrity news. In 2008, it became an online archive with occasional newsstand editions. The backstory is this. Kushner approached Diller about resurrecting Life about 8 months ago, Dealbook hears. His pitch was that the magazine could be resurrected in print and online, as well as in newer iterations like events and collaborations with brands and major studios. Life's legacy lies in its ability to blend culture, current events, and everyday life, highlighting the triumphs, challenges, and unique perspectives that define us, Kushner said in a statement. Dot Dash Meredith will remain involved. It owns the rights to Life's vast photo and content archive and will continue to publish special single-topic print editions. It's the latest high-profile effort to resurrect a legacy publication during a tough time for the media industry. Old-school publishers like Condé Nast and newer ones like Vox and Vice have struggled amid a downturn in advertising. But Kushner, who will serve as Life's publisher, and Kloss are betting that they have a more focused approach that will succeed. We see Life as an uplifting and unifying voice in a chaotic media landscape, Kloss said. The two have already purchased other famous titles. When Bedford was formed last year, it bought the style magazine ID from Vice, and in 2020, Kloss organized an investor consortium to buy the high-end fashion magazine W. What's next? Bedford will begin hiring senior editorial staff for Life, which is tentatively set to resume regular publishing early next year. And we have three short stories in what's happening. First, Disney ends its legal fight with Ron DeSantis over its Florida special tax district. The entertainment giant and the state's governor agreed to cooperate on new growth plans for the 25,000-acre area that encompasses Walt Disney World. It was a surprising end to a bitter fight that saw DeSantis and his allies take over the district and Disney fight back with quiet efforts to lock in its own development plans. Next, Amazon invests $2.75 billion more into Anthropic. The funding brings the tech giant's total stake in Anthropic, a buzzy artificial intelligence startup, to $4 billion. It's the latest sign of tech giant's eagerness to pour money into promising AI technology. Meanwhile, Salesforce reportedly paid more than $20 million to license Albert Einstein's image to promote its AI efforts. And deal-making roars back in the first quarter. About $690.2 billion worth of mergers were announced in the first 3 months of this year, up 30% from the same time last year, according to LSEG. But that growth was driven largely by mega transactions like Capital One's $35 billion bid for Discover Financial Services. The number of announced deals was down 31% year on year. Next article from the Business Roundup, how much time will Bankman-Fried serve? Sam Bankman-Fried, or good old SBF, is set to be sentenced today, this is Thursday, with prosecutors requesting that the FTX founder spend decades in prison and defense lawyers arguing for just a few years. The 32-year-old's fate will hinge on how Judge Lewis Kaplan of the Southern District of New York weighs how much damage he caused to investors and customers and how many of them will get their money back. Prosecutors want Bankman-Fried to serve up to 50 years. The one-time poster child of the crypto industry was found guilty in November of 7 counts of fraud and conspiracy after being charged with stealing billions of dollars to fund a lavish lifestyle and his own investments. In a court filing this month, prosecutors called the fraud historic, pointing to the magnitude of losses and the tens of thousands of potential victims, including unsophisticated retail investors. Bankman-Fried's lawyers are calling for leniency. They have asked for a sentence of no more than 6.5 years and accused the government of pursuing a medieval punishment of an exceptionally brilliant young man with much to offer society. They have also pointed to claims by FTX's lawyers that customers would eventually be repaid. The net harm to customers, lenders, and investors, they said, is zero. FTX's current leader blasted those claims. John Ray told Judge Kaplan this month that recovering the money wasn't guaranteed and would take work by his team. It was categorically, callously, and demonstrably false to say that no harm was caused, he added. Victim restitution won't guarantee a lighter sentence. It's a crime to defraud people, Renato Mariotti, a former federal prosecutor, told DealBook, saying, and the sheer scale of the fraud here was large. He expects a sentence of 20 to 30 years. Mark Kornfield of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney agreed that Bankman-Fried's role in victims regaining their money may not matter much. He's not the one making them whole, he told the Financial Times. Next, a cheat sheet for tomorrow's inflation report. As the S&P 500 heads into the last trading day of the quarter, the index is closing in on a fifth straight monthly gain. Driving that are hopes that the Fed will start cutting interest rates as early as June. But new inflation data could still derail that momentum. The Commerce Department is scheduled to release the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, which is closely watched in Washington, on Friday at 8:30 a.m. Eastern Time. Economists expect another hot number. The question is, how hot? Especially strong data could prod the Fed to delay lowering borrowing costs and affect the number of cuts this year. Here's a few things to watch for. headline PCE for February is expected to show a 2.5% year-on-year gain, a slight increase from the January report. Core PCE, which excludes volatile food and fuel prices, is forecast to come in at 2.8% on an annualized basis, roughly in line with the previous month, and analysts will watch for signs that services inflation spending on things like airfare, health care, and rent has begun to ease. Consumer spending in these areas has remained high in recent months. Fed hawks are weighing in ahead of the report. Christopher Waller, a Fed governor, said in a speech yesterday that the central bank should hold off on cutting rates until he sees at least a couple months of better inflation data. Investors sold off Treasury notes after Waller's comments, but the futures market this morning is still penciling in 3 rate cuts this year, more or less in line with the Fed's most recent forecast. Next article in the Business Roundup, the AI lobby wants to talk about China. As policymakers try to figure out how to regulate the fast-growing artificial intelligence industry, Silicon Valley has ramped up its lobbying efforts to shape the debate. Its latest tactic, tapping into growing worries about China. The Biden administration is doubling down on China's tech threat. That's evident by recent moves such as signaling its support for legislation that could see TikTok banned in the United States. China is producing more top researchers, though the U.S. has a big lead on investments and breakthroughs. Silicon Valley is trying to capitalize on the mood. On May 1st, tech leaders, including Palantir's Alex Karp, Sequoia Capital's Roelof Botha, and Vinod Khosla of Khosla Ventures, are expected to attend a conference in Washington with dozens of lawmakers like Speaker Mikey Johnson, a Republican from Louisiana, if he's still in that job, I guess. Jacob Hellberg, an advisor to Palantir and a member of a congressional commission on China's threats to national security, is organizing the event. For tech companies, Washington's focus on China could be good for business. The other side of slowing down China is minimal friction and regulation for U.S. companies, Amber Koch, a former senior advisor on AI to the FTC, told The Times. The event comes as the industry is ramping up its lobbying efforts. More than 350 organizations reported lobbying the federal government on AI issues during the first 9 months of 2023, spending a total of $569 million on the effort, according to Open Secrets. But a Facebook co-founder is reportedly making a different case. Dustin Moskovitz, a major Democratic donor, met with President Biden last month to share his own arguments about AI safety, according to Puck. Moskovitz and others have warned that mitigating the risk of extinction from AI should be a global priority. His nonprofit group, Open Philanthropy, has advocated regulations like software export controls and licensing requirements for certain AI models. As a side note, I just want to say I watched an excellent show on AI on Nova on PBS yesterday, I think it was. If you get a chance to see it, it's very enlightening and eye-opening. Well, you're listening to the Chris Business Hour. I'll be back with the final segment of this week's show after this break.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Ackerman, a Chris Radio volunteer, with an invitation to join your friends at the Cheshire Lions Club's 66th Annual Dinner Dance for the Blind, to be held Monday, May 6th, 6 to 9:30 p.m. at the AquaTurf Club in Plantsville. This annual party is dedicated to those who have lost their sight and to all Lions who serve by helping in the fight against blindness. The cost is $40 per person, but there is no charge for visually impaired guests and their drivers when sponsored by the Cheshire Lions Club or one of the other area Lions clubs or businesses. For more information about the dance or to register your attendance, please call Lion Bill Manthe at 203-723-4821. That's Bill Manthey at 203-723-4821, or by email at CheshireCTLionsClub@gmail.com. CheshireCTLionsClub@gmail.com. RSVPs need to be in by Monday, April 22nd, so call or email today.
Back to the New York Times, we have an article written by Niraj Chokshi and Sydney Ember. It's titled, Four Takeaways About Boeing's Quality Problems. Boeing has faced intense scrutiny and pressure since a panel blew off a 737 MAX 9 shortly after the plane, an Alaska Airlines flight, took off on January 5th. The episode raised fresh questions about the quality of the planes that the company produces several years after two MAX 8 planes crashed, killing nearly 350 people. Interviews with more than two dozen current and former employees reveal long-standing concerns about quality, particularly as pressure increased to keep production going in the company's factories. Now, Boeing faces an immense challenge as it seeks to make changes that improve the quality of its products and regain its credibility with lawmakers, regulators, airlines, and the public. Here's some takeaways. Quality issues date back years. Current and former Boeing employees said that for years it felt as if quality took a back seat to keeping planes moving through its factories. In interviews, former and current Boeing employees described worrying practices, including attempts to circumvent quality procedures. One was inspector shopping, in which workers would seek out inspectors willing to sign off on work with little pushback. Boeing said it did not allow inspector shopping and had increased the number of quality inspectors for commercial planes 20% since 2019. Even before the two fatal MAX crashes in 2018 and 2019, Boeing was trying to keep up with its main rival, Airbus, which had introduced a new fuel-efficient plane a few years before the MAX began flying. After the crashes, Airbus gained even more ground, putting pressure on Boeing to catch up once the MAX was approved to fly again in late 2020. The company has lost thousands of experienced workers. Boeing's workforce went through a major turnover because of the coronavirus pandemic. The company lost thousands of experienced employees to layoffs, buyouts, retirements, and resignations. Even though Boeing has since replenished its ranks, current and former employees say a lot of institutional knowledge has been lost, and its workers have less experience than they used to. Boeing suppliers facing similar problems have also had trouble producing parts at the rate that Boeing wanted them. And the company is facing heightened scrutiny. Since January 5th, the company has faced wave after wave of negative publicity. Its regulator, the FAA, increased inspections at the company's factories, and its customers have criticized Boeing. Boeing says it's making many changes. Boeing has announced several steps to improve quality, including adding inspections at its factory in Renton, Washington, where MAX planes are assembled. It has also said it will no longer accept MAX bodies from Spirit AeroSystems, a key supplier based in Wichita, Kansas, that still need work. It previously tolerated flaws that could be fixed later in the interest of adhering to a tight production schedule. The company also said that since January 5th, employees have asked for more training and that it was working on meeting those needs, including by adding training on the factory floor this month. And on Monday, Boeing announced sweeping changes to its leadership. Its chief executive, Dave Calhoun, who took the job in January 2020, vowing to improve this company's safety culture, will step down at the end of this year. The head of Boeing's commercial airplane unit, Stan Deal, is leaving immediately, and the board chairman, Larry Kellner, has stepped down from that position and will not seek re-election to the board. Next up from the New York Times, an article written by Ivan Penn. Is titled, U.S. Approves $1.5 billion loan to restart a Michigan nuclear plant. The Biden administration announced on Wednesday that it had agreed to provide a $1.52 billion loan guarantee to help a company restart a nuclear power plant in Michigan, the latest step in the government's effort to revive the nation's reactors. The loan guarantee from the Energy Department will allow Holtec International to revive the Palisades nuclear plant in Covert Township, Michigan, on the shores of Lake Michigan and about 40 miles west of Kalamazoo, and keep it going until at least 2051. The loan guarantee is conditional on the facility receiving regulatory approvals and fulfilling other requirements. The plant ceased operations in May of 2022. Nuclear power plants provide electricity without emitting the greenhouse gas emissions that are warming the planet, a feature that has made them popular with lawmakers and energy executives. But many of the country's nuclear reactors, including the Palisades plant, are at or near the end of their lives and need major upgrades. And few U.S. companies have built new nuclear plants in recent decades because doing so is incredibly expensive and time-consuming. As a result, lawmakers in both parties have backed incentives and subsidies for nuclear energy. Holtec bought the Palisades plant in 2022 in order to close the facility, but later campaigned to reopen the plant with the backing of the Michigan governor, Gretchen Whitmer, a Democrat. Once open, Palisades will be the first successfully restarted nuclear power plant in American history, driving $363 million of regional economic impact and helping Michigan lead the future of clean energy, Ms. Whitmer said in a statement. Federal loan guarantees and grants are expected to help extend the life of other plants and spur the development of new technologies to help ensure there is sufficient power to electrify home heaters, cars, and industry. California in recent years reversed its decision to close the Diablo Canyon power plant on the Pacific Coast because lawmakers are concerned that the state will not have enough sources of electricity to avoid rolling blackouts on hot summer afternoons. The Department of Energy awarded $1.1 billion to Pacific Gas and Electric to continue the plant's operations. Nuclear power is our single largest source of carbon-free electricity, directly supporting 100,000 jobs across the country and hundreds of thousands more indirectly, Jennifer Granholm, Mr. Biden's energy secretary, said in a statement on Wednesday announcing the loan guarantee for the Palisades plant. The United States has the largest nuclear energy operation in the world, with almost 100 units across the country, including two new ones at the Alvin W. Vogtle Generating Plant in Georgia, which took more than a decade to build and cost a staggering $35 billion. Because of the challenges of building large plants like the two Vogtle units, something experts have said was unlikely in the United States in the near future, the Biden administration also has pushed for smaller reactors that could be built more quickly and at a lower cost. Those units, often referred to as small modular reactors, could be built in stages rather than all at once. But no small modular reactors have received full approval and licensing from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Holtec wants to use the site of the Palisades nuclear plant to build two small modular reactors, though the cost of those would not be covered by the loan guarantee announced on Wednesday. Until the small reactors become a reality, a greater focus has turned toward extending the life of nuclear plants already in operation and reviving older units. Next, an article written by Tara Siegel Bernard is titled, Visa and MasterCard Agree to Cap Their Swipe Fees in a Settlement. Visa and MasterCard have agreed to cap the so-called swipe fees that they charge to merchants that accept their credit cards as part of a class action settlement that could save merchants an estimated $30 billion over 5 years, the latest development in a nearly 20-year legal battle. Each time a customer uses one of its credit cards, Visa or MasterCard collects a swipe fee, also called an interchange fee, for processing the transaction, which it shares with banks issuing the cards. The merchants pass those fees along to customers, a practice that effectively inflates prices and may motivate discounts given to customers paying with cash. The settlement, which was announced on Tuesday and is subject to court approval, can be traced back to a 2005 lawsuit by merchants arguing that they paid excessive fees to accept Visa and MasterCard credit cards. As more consumer spending has shifted to credit cards over the years, processing fees have also risen. To accept Visa and MasterCard, U.S. merchants paid $101 billion in total fees in 2023, including $72 billion in interchange fees, according to the Nielsen report, which tracks the payments industry. The fees also generate profits for big banks that issue the cards and indirectly pay for credit card rewards programs, which are not expected to be affected by the settlement deal. In addition to putting a ceiling on the swipe fees, an average of 2.26% of the transaction, according to Nielsen, Visa and MasterCard agreed to roll back the posted swipe fee of every merchant by at least 0.04 percentage points for at least 3 years. For 5 years, the companies will not raise the fees above the posted rates at the end of the previous year. System-wide, the average fee must be at least 0.07 percentage points below the current average rate, a calculation that an independent auditor will verify. Merchants will also be permitted to adjust their prices based on the costs associated with accepting different cards while letting customers know why some cards, typically business cards and those with more rewards and perks, cost more than others. This settlement achieves our goal of eliminating anti-competitive restraints and providing immediate and meaningful savings to all U.S. merchants, small and large, Robert Eisler, co-lead counsel for the plaintiff, said in a statement. But not all merchants, particularly smaller ones, are as optimistic about the proposed changes. Temporary fee reductions fall short of what's needed and underscore why Congress needs to pass legislation to promote a more competitive marketplace, said the Merchants Payments Coalition, a trade group representing retailers, supermarkets, convenience stores, and gas stations, as well as online merchants. The settlement does nothing to actually bring competitive market forces to swipe fees or change the behavior of a cartel that centrally fixes rates and bars competition, said Christopher Jones, a member of the coalition's executive committee and senior vice president of government relations at the National Grocers Association. Instead, it tries to provide token temporary relief and then allows the card companies to raise rates yet again, he added. Senator Richard Durbin, a Democrat from Illinois who has long fought to keep interchange fees in check, introduced bipartisan legislation in June that would require big banks issuing credit cards to enable the cards to be processed on at least one other network besides Visa or MasterCard in an effort to create more options for merchants beyond the two industry heavyweights. Doug Cantor, general counsel at the National Association of Convenience Stores, said the settlement provisions that would allow merchants to charge more for credit cards that carried higher fees will be complicated to carry out and pitted the merchants against their customers. Even if they do use them, it makes the merchants the tax collector for the charges, and it makes merchants the bad guy in the eyes of the consumer, when it's really the credit card companies that are squeezing everyone when it comes to big fees, Mr. Cantor added. Well, you've been listening to the Chris Business Hour from the Bear Cave. I'm Barry Slater. Thank you for listening. Have a great day. Thank you for letting me give you the business.